This is Jack Leffler. Anglo ranchers began to move into the American West in the 19th century. Great herds of cattle replaced bison as a main source of meat. Ranchers homesteaded land and vigorously defended their right to use native habitat to suit their needs. Many thousands of miles of barbed wire fences were strung across the land to contain cattle and other livestock and to act as a statement of territoriality. Around the turn of this century, vast areas of Western landscape began to be dedicated as public lands to be administered by government agencies, including the National Forest Service, the National Park Service, and finally in 1946, the Bureau of Land Management. Public land ranching occurs throughout much of the American West. A rancher may hold title to private land and purchase the rights to graze cattle and sheep on public land from the National Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. Some ranching families have practiced their craft for at least five generations and have come to love the land in a way that cannot be understood by the vast majority of us who live a more contemporary existence. Other ranchers have taken a more corporate approach and have focused their attention on perfecting a system of economics. And more recently, small ranchers have fallen prey to developers who seek to buy their private land and turn it into subdivisions. The early history of cattle ranching in the West frequently resulted in extirpation of predators such as wolves, mountain lions, and coyotes, which were regarded as dangerous to livestock. Overgrazing turned some habitat into badly eroded wasteland. This practice has greatly diminished in recent years as ranchers have come to understand the characteristics of arid habitat and public land administrators hold tighter rein over the number of cattle that may be run on public lands. Still, a hot debate continues between environmentalists, ranchers, and public land administrators as to the fate of public land ranching. This complex issue has no easy solutions. Many contend that traditional ranching families have right to stewardship by virtue of over a century of experience in caring for the land. Others wish to see habitat restored to its original state and be preserved for its own sake rather than for the sake of human interests. Still others wish to brazenly claim the land for other forms of economic development in order to turn habitat into money. On this episode of The Spirit of Place, we shall attempt to begin to build a bridge between the traditional ranching community and environmentalists. We will feature voices of traditional ranchers whose love of the land cannot be measured in terms of money, and whose ranches reflect their collective success in both providing for their cattle and sustaining habitat where wildlife may coexist in a state of balance.
It's little Joe the Wrangler, he'll wrangle nevermore. His days with the remuda, they are o'er. 'Twas a year ago last April when he rode up to our herd, little Texas straying all alone. It was late in the evening when he rode up to our herd on a little old brown pony he called Chaw. With his broken shoes and overalls, a tougher looking kid you never in your life had seen before. He said he had to leave his home, his dad had married twice.
Drum Hadley has had considerable experience as a cowboy and a rancher. He has devoted his life to ensuring that his ranching practices enhance wildlife habitat and nurture his ranch lands.
Ranchers are in the habit of being individualists. And it's the same with cowboys. They are one man existing in a huge space. And there are positive aspects of that in terms of the man being probably more responsible to nearly landforms, who he is around, is maybe a specific canyon or cliffs or a mountain range, and his life begins to be formed by that intimate association with flooding arroyos, droughts, storms, winds, hot sunlight, and his nature is changed by that. He is a different being than someone who can depend on fellow human beings for help. And that individualism, which is developed by one man existing in huge spaces, makes it very difficult for ranchers to get together and meaningfully discuss issues or to criticize one another. Probably they're so glad to see another creature like themselves as well that the tendency is certainly not to criticize or impose one man's ideas on another.
John Peavy is descended from a long-term ranch family who have cared for the Flat Top Ranch in Idaho for generations. He has also engaged in statewide politics and is greatly concerned about the fate of the environment.
You know, there are a lot of people in the communities like we're talking about who do appreciate what the ranching community does, the preservation of the open space, the uniqueness of the old way of life, and they very much enjoy coming out and helping us move sheep. We have a thing called the running of the sheep in the fall when we come down out of the mountains and invite people to meet us and go along and help us keep the animals off of the bike paths. And we invite people to come out to our sheep shippings and cattle drives. And I think that's something the ranchers have got to do more of, is reach out and show people what the ranching industry is all about. And it, to me, it's the most sustainable form of agriculture the world's ever known. I mean, you're harvesting forage that's totally renewable, doesn't require any irrigation. You know, it's grows with a natural rainfall or snowfall. No herbicides, insecticides that tend to get into our aquifers and water supplies. It requires no pumping, very little expenditure of fossil fuels. The industry could operate without any as we did 100 years ago, and on and on. It always will be the most sustainable form of agriculture. Nomadic people all over the world still harvest grass, and the grasslands of the world are probably the biggest area of landmass that we have on Earth.
Work around a ranch is very physical. Many of us have lost touch with physical work, I think. And it is 24 hours a day, every day of the year. There are very few occasions when you can really get away. John is always up at 4 a.m. to go out and, you know, rake hay or start baling or in the summertime or load sheep or move cattle or whatever. When we have our cattle drives every year, they always start at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we work until the sun goes down. And sometimes after that, you'll notice many tractors and farm machinery these days have headlights. People work round the clock. And I've seen that in this entire family. I've seen our son out there 24 hours a day, and they work until they drop. But they care about it. They're connected to it, and they're very proud of it. And they go out when they're not working. After dinner entertainment for us is to get in the pickup and go down and see the wheat crop and to see how it's coming, or to look at the alfalfa leaves and see if they're ready to be cut, if it's time to start haying. It's just an obsession. It's a constant being connected to the land and the product.
You know, a lot of people say, well, you run cattle. Hell, I don't run cattle. I run grass. And if I don't have grass, pretty soon I don't have cattle. And I'm in it for the long haul. My family's been raising grazing animals in southeastern Montana for, 115 years. And the reason we've been able to do that is because we took care of that resource. And that resource isn't the cattle, it's the grass. And we have up years and down years, and eastern Montana is extremely variable. And every once in a while, I'm embarrassed the way my pastures look, but I'll tell you, I get even, because I run less cattle than that country that I own will carry 80% of the time.
If land is not overgrazed, I don't feel that there is very much competition between cattle, say, and deer. Deer, as I'm sure you know, are primarily browsers. That is, they eat brush. Cattle are primarily grass eaters. So as long as you have enough grass for cattle, they're going to continue to eat the grass. Now, if you graze the grass to such an extent that it's very much weakened or it simply isn't there for the cattle to eat, the cattle are going to become primarily browsers. And in that instance, there would certainly be competition with the deer herds. The only predator that really comes to mind is a lion. The lion's natural prey is primarily the deer. And as long as there are enough deer, the lion is going to take deer rather than cattle. Very occasionally it happens that an old lion, because of his physical condition, may find it hard to kill deer, and he may get into the habit of killing calves to survive. In the same way as we found with our chicken coop, sometimes after some years, one coyote will learn when you open the door of the chicken coop in the afternoon, and they just are there eating your chickens. They consider them their chickens or their calves, and in that instance, you have to get rid of that specific animal if you want to continue to have chickens or cows or calves. I recently asked my old friend Warner Glenn, who's a lion hunter and who does hunt in this area, if he had found in any of the stomachs of the lions that he's taken over the last few years any evidence of calf kills, which is like calf hairs, in this area, and he said he hadn't. So it appears as though there's sufficient food for the lion population so that they aren't killing or bothering our cattle at all.
Diane Peavy is a writer whose reflections on life at the Flat Top Ranch are captured in her book, 24 Dirt Road Miles.
I remember clearly the day my husband rushed into our ranch kitchen and breathlessly told me he had seen a wolf. He was a wonderful creature, he added, and for the rest of the day it seemed his mind was far away in the fields with the wild animal again. Several months later, our cowboy told us he heard a wolf one morning when he was gathering the team. He had the same wonder in his voice my husband had had weeks earlier. These events are among my husband's favorite ranch stories. I saw a wolf here about 6 years ago, he'll tell visitors, and our man heard him several months later. For him, it's a part of the mystery of living on the land. Recently, my husband and I went to a wolf recovery program at a friend's house in the city. In the enclosed yard, two long-legged gray-brown animals on leashes strained for attention. Get down on their level, their owner advised. Look them in their eyes and get to know them. We did. Smelling their animalness, looking into their glassy blue eyes, I stroked their coarse fur and wondered what it must have been like to see them in the wild. I thought about my husband's brief moment with one and I envied him the experience. We told a program leader about the wolf at our ranch. The excited young man ran to tell others. Each wolf sighting is an event. Later that evening, the hosts ran a film on these animals. My husband leaned forward in his chair as if he might join them in their mountain freedom. They howled on the screen once, then again, and everyone in the room became silent, stunned by the chilling sound. My husband leaned even closer to the screen. Then the image changed in front of us. A rancher was rounding up cattle, and instantly I realized that he was the bad guy. Livestock, the narrator said, crowded out wolves. Now ranchers are resisting their reemergence, afraid the wild animal will kill their sheep and cattle. I looked at my husband. He had drawn back and sat small in his chair. And I realized suddenly we were the enemy for people looking for simple solutions. And I felt isolated in this room of friends.
I've always thought of myself as an environmentalist, and I resent very much being maneuvered along with others in my industry, the grazing industry, being maneuvered into an anti-environmentalist kind of a stature. And I think there's a lot of fault on both sides. The ranchers, for their part, probably were not well led. The leadership in the past hasn't been particularly far-sighted. They have not been open to new ideas. They have not tried to communicate and listen and to really what the other side was saying. And the environmental community is basically, I think, have just lost their way. A lot of the people, the direction they're going is really anti-environmental. The safest and best management of these lands are in long-time family operations where people fall in love with the place, the land. They have a sense of history, a sense of being, a sense of place, a home, their homeland. They've almost become indigenous. And if you convince those ranching families that something bad is happening to that land, they will go to great effort. They'll make a lot of sacrifices to try to set things straight and do things in a different, more environmentally sound way. They always have.
The livestock industry has allowed itself to be politically and sometimes philosophically allied with some people that I'm extremely uncomfortable with. And that's a clear-cut loggers and the hard rock miners that are constantly trying to defend the federal mining law of 1872, that it was written on parchment, it's so old and out of date. What burns me up is the strip mining for coal and how we could align ourselves and ally ourselves with extractive industries when we, you know, maybe the logging isn't an extractive industry, but when they clear-cut it is, and how misguided it seems to me that sometimes we feel an affinity for some people that I think are a lot less responsible as far as we are. I think some blame also lies in the environmental camp because they didn't really understand, because we allowed ourselves to be painted the same black color as some of the people. They lumped us in there with the rapers and takers too, and I think that that's a misconception for the most part. You know, I think that there are incidences of abuse. I think the livestock community is, you know, and I'll be hung for a heretic by saying this, probably by my contemporaries in the livestock community. I think that grazing livestock, grazing domestic livestock, belong on public land. I think that grazing private domestic livestock should pay the going rate as far as grazing lease price on public land. I don't think that's the case. I've come through generations of a politically and economically conservative family, and I am embarrassed to think that my industry needs a subsidy to graze on public land. And I don't think it's fair to people that are running on private deeded land when some of the members of the livestock grazing community are subsidized by the federal government and the taxpayers and the people. It's as big a subsidy as the 1872 mining law is, and maybe that's why we've aligned ourselves. It's as big a subsidy as a lot of the road building and things where you clear-cut trees and you end up with less bucks in your pocket as far as the public's concerned when you've got the trees out than you had before, because the Forest Service has spent more money making it easy to go in there, and it's an economic loss. So I think that grazing fees should be raised to an equitable basis, and I don't think that that federal grazing land, that BLM land or that Forest Service land, is as valuable as a private lease. On a private lease, a lot of times you get some benefits, you get some water development, you also get some fences and things like that.
I need to describe this ranch. We have one primary canyon which runs through it, which is the preferable riparian area that I'm speaking about. What I've done is run a fence along the north side of that canyon, which excludes cattle from watering where they previously watered, which was from the waters of the canyon. I've run pipelines to the north and developed alternative waters as much as a mile and a half and 2 miles in away from the canyon, where previously there were no permanent waters. By excluding cattle from the canyon, the cattle have to use these waters, which are at some distance from the canyon, and they are in much better feed than they would be if they continued to have access to the canyon, to the riparian area of the canyon. So economically, I feel that we are getting much more use from our rangeland than we would have been if I hadn't fenced out the riparian area. Both the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service are very willing today to supply fencing materials to control and limit the access of cattle to riparian areas. I feel, however, that the imposition of the hardship of requiring some of these small ranching families to remove cattle from riparian areas has driven them out of business, has caused them to sell their land to the highest bidder, who generally is a developer. I am very sorry that those families have had to, in a sense, they are becoming extinct. I mean, they are like the last of a species, especially those families who've been around for a number of generations, because the knowledge of how to exist in the rangeland economically with cattle or with sheep as well has taken a number of generations to find itself and become whole in the American West. I feel that those people themselves should begin to be treated with the kind of care that the last of various species are now being treated.
Gary Snyder is one of America's most venerated poets and is greatly respected for his thinking concerning the relationship between cultural and biotic diversity.
The larger picture is one in which these endangered lifestyle ranchers share the same space with the family farmer of the Midwest or with the small-scale lumber operator and logger of the Pacific Northwest. And it's a larger problem than just a problem for ranchers. It's a problem that is affecting, on a very large scale, the small family farm. As one of my friends said, if you look at what is at work making things tough for the small rancher, the small logger, or small sawmill family farm, it isn't environmentalists. It's the dynamics of the economy as a whole. You certainly can't blame environmentalists for the problems of family farmers. And, you know, certainly in the case of the West and the increasing ante that is being imposed on people in terms of grazing fees and maybe requirements on how many head they graze and how much they graze, that certainly is coming through as a pressure from the environmentalist community. But the larger picture is, as many an economist would tell you, these things aren't viable anyway, they'd say. Under no conditions are these things economically viable, just as they say the same about farming. And they'll tell you right up front, what we ought to do with farming is get rid of all family farmers, treat it all pragmatically as agro-industry or agribusiness. So that's one level of discussion that, you know, at some point or another has to be dealt with, is you know, what is the larger economic impact of it when we're looking at the fact that in the United States as a whole, only highly industrialized, highly capitalized agriculture makes any profit, and the rest of it just scrapes by. Or if you were to ask, what is endangering your farm business most? One, radical environmentalists. Two, prices and the economy. Or three, bureaucratic paperwork. In which order is it the biggest pain in the ass? And, you know, bureaucratic paperwork and the economy are going to be right up there with radical environmentalists, who are often simply the scapegoat. Because, like we've seen in the timber industry, you know, all of these controversies that were in the papers last year about spotted owls and old-growth forest in the Northwest, and that was really a big issue. The industry scapegoated the environmentalists across the board. And what they weren't saying was that they're making plenty of money and they're setting up sawmills outside the United States, like down in Mexico, and that their major trading partner is Japan, that the strictures that environmentalists bring to bear on it is just a tiny part of the picture. But they are very easy to scapegoat, and the public will, you know, even the loggers themselves will go for it. When if they stop and think twice, you know, they're going to look around at all of the factors that are at play in their local economy.
Wally McRae was born into a Montana ranch family and is highly respected as an environmental activist. He is one of our leading cowboy poets.
Remember that sand rock on Emil's Creek, where Dad carved his name in 13? It's been blasted down into rubble and interred by a dragline machine. Where Fatals lived at the old Myler place, where us kids stole melons at night, they dozed it up in a funeral pyre and torched it. It's gone, all right. The sea on the hill and the water tanks are now classified reclaimed land. They're thinking of building a golf course out there, so I understand. And the old Egan homestead's an ash pond that they say is 80 feet deep. And the branding krill at the Douglas camp is underneath the spoil heap. And across the creek is a tipple now where they load coal onto a train. And the May West rock on Hay Coulee, just black and white snapshots remain. There's a railroad loop and a coal storage shed where the bison kill site used to be. And the Guy place is gone. And Ambrose's too. Beulah Farley's a ranch refugee. But things are booming. We've got this new school that's envied across the whole state. And when folks up and ask, how's things going down there? Hell, I grin like a fool and say, great. Great God, how we're doing. We're rolling in dough as they tear and they ravage the earth. And nobody knows, or nobody cares, about things of intrinsic worth.
Taught him how to herd the horses, learned to know them all, to round them up by daylight if he could, to saddle the old chuck wagon and always hitch the team and help coast the narrow Russell Wood. We had driven to Red River. The weather had been...
On this episode of The Spirit of Place, we have heard from Wally McRae, John and Diane Peavy, Drum Hadley, Gary Snyder, and Poncho Baird. This 13-part radio series was produced for the Western States Arts Federation in association with KUNM-FM Albuquerque by Jack Leffler and Elaine Thatcher. Funding for this series was provided by the Ruth Mott Fund, the New Mexico Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Utney Reader Magazine, offering thought-provoking points of view on culture and society from over 2,000 media sources. Please visit Utney Reader on the World Wide Web at utney.com. That's www.utne.com. This is Jack Leffler inviting you to remain attuned to the spirit of place. Thank you for listening.
There was one missing, and we all knew at a glance, 'twas our little Texas stray, Wrangler Joe. Next morning, just at daybreak, we found where Rocket fell, down in the washout 20 feet below. And beneath the horse lay little Joe, his spur had rung the knell for our little Texas stray, poor Wrangler Joe.